This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined by Brock Allen, security architect, consultant, and co-creator of Identity Server. Thanks for joining me this morning, Brock.
Hi, no problem.
To start off, can you tell me a little bit about who you are and what you do, please?
Sure. So I mainly focus on identity and access control in the security space. That basically involves single sign-on and protecting web APIs.
And your own background, how did you get into this?
Yeah, so in terms of my background, I've done ASP.NET development for years and years and years, ever since it, came out. I guess it's been 15 years now. And, I did a lot of training on just the core ASP.NET. And, but part of it was security. It was always an interest, really interesting thing to me. It's amazing what clever things people can do to make your app not work the right way. And so, always thinking about how to be defensive and how to protect against those things. Those are the, that's what's always been very interesting to me about security space.
But to even get into that field, the general thing you read in any book is don't home bake security.
Sure.
But obviously, to get an interest in it and to start figuring it out, you did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you definitely have to write a lot of code. You have to write apps that are probably, you make a lot of mistakes and write apps that are not very secure. And then you discover, oh my gosh, look what I did, how stupid, and look what an attacker could do to my app. You learn and you iterate over that sort of process. And it definitely helps to write a lot of code to understand how to, attack, but also how to defend an application. And then it just never ends, in fact, because it's so, a lot of very smart people out there, like I said, and they can do lots of clever things.
And I suppose you weren't releasing these things into production, the homemade ones at first.
We all make mistakes. And, when you have a job and you're working for somebody and you accident, you put something out and you don't know any better. It happens. I'll admit I've put buggy code out there before. We all do, right?
Oh, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
But now your focus for the last few years has been Identity Server.
Yes.
So can you tell me what that is?
Right. So Identity Server is a framework. It's built on .NET, and the framework is an implementation of these security protocols called OpenID Connect and OAuth2. And these are modern security protocols for achieving single sign-on and allowing you to help protect your web APIs if you want to do, secure authentication to those.
So OpenID Connect and OAuth2, they are standards beyond Identity Server and beyond Microsoft. Is that fair?
Right, absolutely. There's a specification committee, and there are lots of companies involved. So Microsoft is involved with that. So is Google and Facebook and Salesforce. A lot, the big companies you've all heard of, and they're basically coming together to put together these specifications for achieving these things that we need in modern application architectures. One of the really nice things about these protocols is that they're designed for all the different types of modern apps that we're building these days. So, we're building web applications, server-side web applications like MVC or ASP.NET. We're building lots of client-side web applications like JavaScript, SPA-style applications. We're, of course, building web APIs, right? That's how we do our distributed computing these days. And then, of course, mobile apps. And so these specifications and these protocols are designed to accommodate all of those scenarios, allow you to secure them, get a user logged in, and then allow these apps to call your web APIs, securely on behalf of the user.
Do you use OpenID Connect and OAuth together, or are they different things that do the same purpose?
So this is definitely a bit of confusion. There also has to do with the sort of the legacy or the ordering of these specifications. So OAuth2 came first, and OAuth2 was the specification that allowed you to protect web APIs. So the idea is that instead of using a username and password to authenticate with a web API, we use these things called tokens. And so it's really all about, it's a level of indirection for securing the web API. But the point is you get this thing called a token, and you then can call your API, and the API can, authenticate the user based on that token. The thing about that specification is that actually doesn't add or doesn't provide you with authentication into the app itself. So you have an app that's calling an API, and OAuth allows you to know who the user is at the API level, but the app itself, the calling app, doesn't know who the user is. So a lot of companies like Facebook and Twitter and all these other companies, you can add some features to OAuth, some parameters to turn it into an authentication protocol. And they all kind of hacked it up and they all did it in their own way. And the problem was that that's not interoperable. So the OpenID Connect specification group got together and said, okay, we know people are hacking up OAuth. So let's actually, you know, standardize the special sauce you have to add to OAuth to give it the authentication piece. And so that's what OpenID Connect is that it's on top of OAuth, and it adds in or layers in that additional bit to achieve authentication. So strictly speaking, OAuth is for calling web APIs, and OpenID Connect is for authenticating the user.
Okay, so the difference being the original one, OAuth, would have been the more API to API call, or yep, application to API, and exactly, then OpenID Connect was more for people. Is that fair?
Yes, for authenticating the user to the app, this also is going to give you things like single sign-on, because the typical architectural pattern is that you set up one of these things, one of these OpenID Connect servers, and then you have multiple apps, and then the multiple apps all trust it, and that's part of how the whole single sign-on piece comes into this.
What's an example of a company using OpenID Connect that, let's say, I would have used and I might not be aware of it?
Sure. Well, you've logged in with Google, right?
Yep.
Yeah, they're using OpenID Connect.
When you say they're using it, and I log into my Gmail and I can go into my calendar and I can go into my Drive, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, in a sense, that's what you're doing, is that you don't log into each of these apps multiple times, right? You log into Google, and once you've logged into Google, then that's your single sign-on provider. And then as you navigate to these other apps, they're taking advantage of the, you know, the fact that you've singly signed on, and then you're using, I don't know, Google Calendar, and I'm sure that loaded in the browser, right, is calling back to their servers, calling web APIs. So they are getting these access tokens to call those web APIs as part of that single sign-on process.
I diverged a little bit from what I had intended. To go back to Identity Server. Obviously, you are one of the, as we said at the start, a co-creator. Yep. Who else is involved in Identity Server?
Yeah, so it's pretty much me and one other individual named Dominic Bayer. He's from Germany, and he and I have known each other for 10 or 11 years now. We actually used to train together at the training company that I mentioned earlier. We used to train together at ASP.NET. And he also, he actually had even more of a security background than I did. He came from more of a penetration testing sort of background. Anyway, we hit it off because we were both really interested in, you know, the plumbing of how security worked in ASP.NET, the stuff that we were both training on. And so, you know, we hit it off. We did a lot of collaboration over the years, and most concentrated bits been in the last 5 years. We came together to, you know, work on this open source stuff together, and we definitely complement each other very well. And like I said, I think it works well putting together this framework that people can use.
And you said he's in Germany still?
Yeah.
And you're U.S. East Coast?
Yes, I am on the East Coast.
And is that good, bad, difficult?
We actually work out pretty well. We both do consulting. So, you know, he might be off consulting 1 week and I might be off consulting. But the weeks that we're both at home working on the open source projects, we tend to get on Skype. We tend to do a lot of pair programming over Skype. And we might spend, it's always funny when we end the call on Skype, because it'll be like 4 hours or whatever. We spend many, many hours on Skype. That actually works out really well. The only downside is that it's usually in my morning and his evening. So he's drinking, you know, a beer, or if it's late enough, he's already onto his whiskey. And so I'm unfortunately, you know, stuck early morning listening to the sips across the Skype Skype audio.
When I was preparing for the podcast, I came across many articles, and quite a few of them were on his website, Least Privilege.
Yep.
And then you have a website too, I presume, with blog posts.
Yep. It's just brockallen.com.
Brockallen.com, yeah. So when I was doing the search, for whatever reason, on my my search engine, his ones came up.
Sure.
So that's why I was just a little bit more familiar.
Yeah, he's definitely better on the whole the public facing front in terms of, you know, being more prolific with blogging and things like that.
All right, we're going to go back again, maybe into a little bit more of the technical side of Identity Server. But to start off, what's wrong with just a username and password? Because, you know, when I came to ASP.NET, I had web forms and I can't remember the other kind of authentication, but they were both just username, password, and they were simple and easy. I could store them in a database. Right. I could verify them. I was sure the person who they claimed to be, and they were logged in and off we went.
Right. Right. So the world used to be a simpler place. Absolutely. So there are a couple different things with this. One, in terms of the single sign-on concept, right? If you have, username and password can work fine for a regular web app. You are then in the business of managing credentials, which is, you know, a tricky business because are you storing them properly? Are you protecting against all the standard sort of attacks, the brute force attacks that somebody could mount against your login, you know, process of your app? So you have to obviously deal with all that. But then imagine you build your second app and your third app and your fourth app, right? You have to redo all of that effort over and over and over in every one of your apps. So I don't think passwords are something that you can eliminate, but the whole idea of a single sign-on solution is that you take all of that and you centralize it, and then you put that in one place, and it can then convey then the identity of the user over to the multiple apps. So the apps now that your average business developer is writing doesn't have to worry about the security side of it as much, I suppose. You leave that to a security professional who can focus on that single sign-on provider. And, you know, that's an improvement right there.
Back in the day, again, just to go back to be kind of devil's advocate, I had done some single sign-on in web forms apps by setting, I think, the machine.config key and the something else key. Mm-hmm. And as long as they were the same, then my cookies would be encrypted the same, so I could have the same login across multiple servers. And all was good.
Sure.
What's wrong with that?
It depends on your context. There are actually some fundamental problems with the machine key element itself. That's one protection key, right? That's one key for your entire app. And it's in, you know, most people leave it in plain text in the config file. You know, there are lots of, if you Google for machine key very frequently, you will see the plain text served up from people's apps, which means then, you know, people can own your app. But the other thing is that there are a lot of internal reasons why, there are a lot of internal values within an ASP.NET application that need to be protected. And there's only one key for the whole thing. There were several problems with that. And it turns out in ASP.NET Core, that's actually been eliminated because of all of the fundamental design problems with it. So, I mean, again, you had to create the key. You were in charge of managing where to put the key. You had to synchronize the key. And in ASP.NET Core, they have eliminated that, and they completely take over the management of that. So they actually generate the keys for you, and they actually do the storage for you. And it's not in your application directory as well.
One of the things you mentioned there about you're protected against standard attacks by not doing this whole username and password, would you be referring to things like brute force attacks on a dictionary, a database table that was compromised and you didn't do good hashing and salting?
So yeah, there are a couple different attack vectors there. One is if an attacker does steal your database, then they can do these offline attacks against whatever's in your database. So yeah, that's one attack vector. And then that means you have to have protected the credentials in that database, and you know they're not going to be 100% protected. Over, you know, with enough time, an attacker will be able to brute force that. But if you protect them properly, then it slows the attacker down, and that gives you enough time to react, inform your user base, you know, figure out what sort of a press release you're going to have to put out to apologize for the fact that you were compromised, things like that. And you want to have as much time as possible for that, rather than, you know, your database being poorly protected where the accounts can be, you know, cracked in a few hours. You want a few days or a few weeks or a few months. So that's one attack vector. The other one is basically through the front door, right? You have a login page and you're allowing an anonymous user to submit credentials, and you immediately come back and say, yeah, that was good, or no, that was bad. So that's another attack vector where somebody just writes a like an automated tool to just guess through the front door. And if you don't mitigate against that, that's another, you know, vector. So these are all the kinds of things you have to think about protecting that stuff.
And then Identity Server comes with those out of the box?
So that's the other interesting thing, is that Identity Server is a framework. It's designed primarily for these protocols, for single sign-on and OAuth, and it's very extensible. So it's designed to allow you to customize it the way you need. So in terms of the actual database that you put there for your users, that's actually a pluggable piece that you're required to put in there. So you would want to bring, an implementation of an identity management, database that does these things properly. So ASP.NET Identity, which I'm sure you've heard of, is one option. I wrote an identity management library years ago called Membership Reboot. That was sort of my rebuttal to the crummy membership system that used to exist in ASP. Actually, Membership Reboot came before ASP.NET Identity, and I would like to somehow think that I was a little bit responsible for them working harder and making their identity management library better than it was previously. So, so Identity Server, you do have to provide that piece. So you might have a legacy database that you're just stuck with, or you can plug in one of these more, newer identity management databases.
And again, to come back to Identity Server, how does its authentication work? I know we covered the OpenID Connect and the OAuth, but specifically Identity Server.
So what happens is you will set up Identity Server in a centralized, location. You'll build however many apps that you need to that trust it. When a user comes to your app to log in through the browser, your app will redirect them to Identity Server to get signed in. Just like you would if you were hosting that within your local own app, right? You would redirect the user to your own login page. Now it's just Identity Server's login page. At the login, though, of Identity Server, then this is where your custom database would come into play. So the credentials would come into Identity Server, again, through some, UI. We have a default one, but you can customize it as well. This would then get validated against your credential database. But Identity Server then takes over and completes the OpenID Connect protocol handshake, which is delivering the user back to your app and proving their identity. So there are tokens involved. There are, query string parameters being passed around. And so that's really what the OpenID Connect protocol is more around, is the handshake on the network from your app over to the centralized location and back.
Am I right in saying that the user still uses a username and password?
So that's the other thing about Identity Server, is that of course, given the flexibility, is that you can plug in anything you want. So add Identity Server, you could do a username and password, but you could also do something else. You could actually use a smart card, for example, right? If you wanted to plug in a X509 certificate smart card system where the user had to do a CAC card or whatever, that's totally possible. You can then also have Identity Server use some other identity provider, like a Google login or like a Facebook login or an Azure Active Directory login. So that's actually a really common use case, is that people put Identity Server in between their apps and then Azure and Google and Facebook. And so in essence, Identity Server is shielding all of your apps from the details of how they get logged in from all these external providers. That's basically called a federation gateway pattern. Which is where Identity Server then, is sort of your set of applications, identity as a service. And if the details of getting the user logged in means sending them to Google or entering a credential or using a smart card, so be it. But your app doesn't have to worry about all those details.
Sometimes when I see those things, though, I get a little bit suspicious, because I remember there was some app and it was offering me the option. I think it was just LinkedIn was my way of signing in. But they wanted to see my profile. They wanted to see who I was connected to. They wanted to see lots of things. And they were also, I think, granting themselves permission to put posts on my feed.
Right, right.
And, I see a lot of problems with
that. Yeah, no, absolutely. So that is part of the role of OAuth and OpenID Connect, is that when you are you building an app and you're then using some identity provider, say it's LinkedIn. In that scenario, the identity provider, so LinkedIn, is not the same company as the app itself. So they're third party to one another. And so what you saw there was what we call the consent screen. The consent screen is a really important part of this, where before we deliver the user back to the app, we check with the user one last time and say, hey, hold on, this app, you know, who we don't really know much about, is asking for all of this stuff about you. They're asking for your identity information, maybe your email, like you said, but also permissions to call their APIs, posting on their, you know, posting on your LinkedIn, you know, feed or whatever. And so that's actually the OAuth part of that, where, you know, the API call would have given the app permission. So that's a really important piece, is the consent to allow the user to, you know, to opt out, to basically say, whoa, no, that's not what I want to do. With Identity Server, the consent is part of our implementation. And you can, with our implementation, the nice thing is that you can actually give the user the ability to pick each individual permission, if you will. So if the user wants to allow you to log in but not call the API, for example, in Identity Server, the user has the option to just uncheck that checkbox, and we will not give that sort of permission then to the calling app. So that's, again, part of the whole protocols and the specifications is that's an important piece. And, you know, as you would imagine, given a spec compliant implementation, you know, we offer that as well.
So after authentication, then within Identity Server, you have some other concepts. You have a specific concept around users. Can you talk about that, please?
So yeah, so Identity Server, again, is giving you single sign-on to these apps, protecting your APIs, and then, you know, all of this is on behalf of your users. So those are the three main things that Identity Server needs to be configured with, is who are your users, who are your apps, and what are your APIs? And so those are the main configuration options that you have to set up when you're using Identity Server. So that's what I said earlier about how the users in Identity Server, that's your own custom database. You have to bring that to Identity Server because your situation is going to be different than everyone else's.
And after a user has logged in, I'm used to things like roles. Mm-hmm. I am an administrator. I am a manager. I'm a supervisor. I'm a whatever. But you're gone down the road of claims.
Right. So that's another thing. Is it? So yes, from the way we thought about authorization 10 years ago was that you had a user, they had a name, right? And then they had all these things called roles. And those are binary, right? You're an admin or not. So like I said, we've sort of evolved past that, where applications need more information about your user, right? They need your email. They need your first name. They need your last name. They might need your, I don't know, whatever other identity data that your system has about the user, right? Maybe an airline application would have your airline, you know, status, gold or platinum or whatever. So in the old APIs in .NET, they didn't have a way to accommodate this. So they had to come up with, you know, these other things like the, I don't know if you remember the ASP.NET profile system. I even forget what it was called. But anyway, they had to come up with workarounds for the fact that the core security APIs only knew about roles. And so finally, Microsoft kind of like saw the light and said, oh, hey, out in the literature, there are these things called claims. And a claim is a more general way to represent, you know, any kind of identity information. And so the thing about a claim is that it's like a key value pair. So it's a type and a value. So you could have a claim, which is your email. The type of claim is email, and the value is, you know, whatever at gmail.com. And so that's how you convey identity information in a more modern way, because it's very simple. It's highly interoperable. So if this data is coming from your database, great. You create these key value pairs. If the data is coming from Google, guess what? Google is going to hand you a bunch of key value pairs. And the thing about this is then roles can also be represented with these key value pairs, right? The type of claim is role and the value is administrator. And by virtue of it being there, you're an administrator. If you don't have it, it's the same as if you didn't have the role. So that's the really, it's actually a little painful because Microsoft is, you know, to poo-poo Microsoft a little bit, they're not very good about educating people on some of these things. And so they still, unfortunately, treat roles special, wherein they're not really, they're just claims. So the way we build all of our systems these days is that you just have claims. And if you want to know if the user is an administrator, you go look for the role claim. And if it's there, you know they're an admin. Okay. But again, you could build all your other authorization on more sophisticated types of lookups on the user, right? Maybe their email or maybe their airline status, for example.
What would be an example, though, just to make it more concrete? Let's say I've got a web API or an MVC controller, an action method that maybe deletes an account, for example.
Yep.
What would be an example of using a claim to give permissions to some users but not to others to perform that action?
Okay.
So how would you do it?
Right. So what is, well, first of all, I would talk to the business and say, what's the business requirement around authorization of this activity? Right. And so if it's deleting this kind of record, then maybe an admin can delete the record. And then maybe the owner of the record can delete the record. Okay. So you have to build your authorization logic around those two rules. And, what the first rule, the admin rule, is pretty easy, right? You come in, the incoming user, you check their claims and you see if they have the admin role, and then you know they're an admin, good to go, delete the record. If the user's not an admin, then maybe you check your next, you know, logic around your authorization logic, and you say, okay, well then the user is Brock. And so, okay, then I look up the record in the database and I see what the owner of the record is. And, oh, Brock is the owner of the record. I let that through. So, yeah, you have to write some code, right? You have to write some code. You look at these attributes of the user and you know, you use those as an input into whatever your authorization logic is.
But then it's, as you say, it's coded into that method. So you would have your if statements or whatever, and then you would perform the action if allowed.
Exactly.
No, now, is there also the concept, I'm blanking on the name for it, but when you have the square brackets above an action method, that's called an attribute?
You have the authorization attribute. Yeah, so you have the old authorize attribute, and in there you could put roles and things like that. So what I was about to say a second ago, and that relates to the attribute as well, is that you can code up your authorization the way we just described. There is a bit of a complaint against that, though, which is you are now coupling your authorization logic with your business logic. And while they may be related, they still, you know, sort of a separation of concerns, right? Your authorization logic might need to be invoked from multiple locations, not just right here in the operation itself. So there's been a pattern over the years to decouple these two. So you take that authorization logic and you put it in somewhere separate location. And then you, from your activity, you know, from the operation in your code, you then call out to the separate authorization system layer, whatever that is. So the authorize attribute that you were just asking about, that unfortunately violates that decoupling, right? Because by putting a list of roles in the authorize attribute, you're back to your coupling. And so the problem is you might need that list of roles or whatever the other logic is from multiple locations. Think about the there's obviously the in the business logic where you're, you know, performing the submit to the server to do the database update. But what about the UI itself, right? The UI may have the button which says delete the user or, you know, delete the record that you're talking about. So you actually also need that logic in the UI because you might want to hide or show the button. So by decoupling the authorization into a separate component, then you can invoke that same logic, not only from the operation itself, but from the UI code as well. And then also over time, as your rules change, you have only one place to change the code, which is a nice pattern. So this is all leading up actually to something I wanted to mention, which is in ASP.NET Core, they've actually introduced a whole new authorization system around this architectural pattern. And it's called policy-based authorization. And actually this was sort of galvanized in the ASP.NET team because Dominic and I, we had been working several years ago on this entire pattern. We even came up with a little framework to help people decouple this code. And, you know, we put it up on GitHub and in one of our NuGet packages. And it worked all right. It definitely was a first step in the right direction to do this decoupling. But we took it to Microsoft. We were at the MVP summit a couple of years ago, and we got to meet with the ASP.NET team, and we showed this to them. We said, look, hard coding your roles right in your, or even your claims checks right in the business logic itself is really, you know, kind of an anti-pattern. So we came up with this little framework to decouple them. It's good, but we, you know, it's still not, it doesn't have the right polish. So we kind of handed it over to them and said, hey, make this better. And so they did. They went off and for, you know, spent a long time working on it. And then in ASP.NET Core, they come up with this new policy-based authorization system. So I'm quite excited about it because it definitely is encouraging good style when you're, you know, writing your authorization security logic.
But this policy, the policy system in ASP.NET Core, that's not a replacement or a substitute for Identity Server?
No, it's totally different. So this is your authorization logic. Identity Server is really about identifying the user, right? That's that's single sign-on. That's authentication as a service. Authorization, obviously, necessarily comes after that.
So this leads me to my next question very nicely. So Microsoft has taken care of the authorization, and Identity Server has the authentication.
Sure.
So, you know, not to be rude, but are you building this for Microsoft?
No, we're not building this for Microsoft. We're building it for our customers. So there's a kind of an interesting little backstory about that, though, is that in Katana, right? So Katana was the kind of the first step towards a more modern web framework that was released in 2013, at least as part of Visual Studio. And they had a whole new programming style with middleware and things like that. They introduced a framework to do OAuth. And it was called the OAuth 2 Authorization Server Middleware from Microsoft. So they took a stab at building something that is kind of similar to what Identity Server does. It's something that will issue these tokens to allow you to protect a web API. And it turns out then they discontinued it because they realized that building this token service that implements OAuth or even OpenID Connect is a lot of work, and their implementation, while it provided a lot of the protocol level details, but there was still a tremendous amount of work that an application developer would have to do around it to really make it properly secure. And that would mean you have to really understand the protocols. So the framework itself that they offered, unfortunately, wasn't really providing a lot of benefit, to be honest. So they realized, okay, well, let's deprecate this. Let's not continue it forward. So they did not continue that middleware forward into ASP.NET Core, also because they knew that we were working on Identity Server. So, I mean, we do work quite, I wouldn't say closely with Microsoft, but we definitely talk to them a lot. We're very vocal about when they get things wrong with security. And so anyway, we talk to them quite a bit. And also, by the way, we're very vocal when they get things right. So the, like I said, the policy-based stuff, they did a great job on. So anyway, since they knew that we were working on Identity Server and they knew that we already had lots of customers using Identity Server and it is, you know, doing a great job of giving people these security features in their application architecture, they decided, okay, we'll just let the, you know, let that community effort, you know, kind of take the place of what we tried to do before. So yeah, they are basically publicly promoting Identity Server, and they are publicly saying that yes, Identity Server is what you should do to protect your web APIs and, you know, do single sign-on if you need it within your application architecture.
And it's great to see Microsoft doing that. I know they've been going more open source for many years, and I know that they've been getting many more community contributions, but I think in from what I've seen, this is kind of the first de facto open source non-built thing that they're really pushing. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are others too. I mean, there were things that came before. I mean, of course, JSON.NET is the big, you know,
yeah,
they
Newton
use
Soft.
That all internally. Exactly, the Newton Soft library. I think they're pretty happy with AutoMapper as well.
Oh, I didn't realize that they were encouraging that one.
Yeah,
I use it all the time.
Yeah, Jimmy Bogard's library. Yep. I mean, I think even something in Entity Framework, I don't know if it was Entity Framework or something in one of the SQL Server libraries actually was using it internally. I forget exactly what. But anyway, they had a dependency on it. So there are definitely some things like that that they're very keen on. They actually did this in the past with .NET OpenAuth. That was even longer ago. But yeah, so but you're right. I'm very pleased that Microsoft is willing to let us, kind of own that space, and because that's all we do full time, right? They have their ASP.NET team. They have lots of other things to worry about, and this is something we just focus on. And we do that obviously in our open source. We do that for customers with the consulting. We help people design their application architectures around these protocols. I end up doing that a lot with people as sort of just a knowledge transfer education on how these security protocols protect your apps and how they're designed to be used and how they're not designed to be used. And then of course, if people want to use Identity Server then to fit into their system, then I help people customize that and set up prototypes and get it to production.
I guess one of the advantages you have as a security architect consultant is that you're out seeing how real companies are doing things and the mistakes that they're making. And that kind of leads me on to the question about testing Identity Server. So, it's very easy to build something and see that it works in a particular way, but obviously it probably works and breaks in 100 other ways. I imagine you're in a better position perhaps than some of the Microsoft people because they're, working inside Microsoft. They don't see the industry the same way. But, taking that into account, how do you test Identity Server? How do you hammer it? How do you break it?
So there are a couple different things there. One is the thing about you mentioned about customers, and that's actually what I love doing is going to customers and helping them solve their problems because of course everybody has some unique requirement that we have to figure out how to solve. And so that's the thing I'm pretty proud about with Identity Server is that from a flexibility standpoint, it is very customizable. And so for the most part there's some way you can add a little bit of extensibility code to Identity Server to solve these customer problems. So definitely we get a lot of that. And that feedback, by the way, gets rolled back into Identity Server as well. If we see somebody with some use case that was like, oh wow, that's a great idea, we try to figure out how to roll that back into the design of Identity Server. In terms of testing Identity Server, so here's what I would recommend, and this is what we recommend to everyone, is that don't take our word for it, right? You should be testing Identity Server yourself. So if that from a like a pen testing standpoint, from a security standpoint, obviously you're not going to trust the vendor of some product to say, oh yeah, we're perfectly secure, right? So that's just bad advice to just straight up trust someone like that. So we highly encourage people to do their own penetration testing on Identity Server for what their use cases are, or for what they've deployed. The other thing about it is that because so much of Identity Server is customizable and extensible, a lot of your code is running in it. So it's hard for us to know if you've gotten it done, if you've done everything right. So that's actually another reason why we highly encourage you to do your own like security vetting on it. But yeah, from our own standpoint, we have lots of friends in the industry who do that kind of a testing. So we've done our own internal testing. Just last week, I had a customer who was doing a lot of stress testing. So I helped them with their stress testing, and we found some issues, and we work on them, and help the customer then be successful in their deployment. I think it's just like any other piece of software, though, is that if you have to know how you're using it, and because Identity Server does support all these different configurations, just because the specifications allow for all these different scenarios, everyone's using it differently. So the way you use it might be different than somebody else. So you have to test that for how you're using it.
Building something like this sounds almost like a full-time job, but you have a full-time consulting gig
Sure.
also. How do you balance the two?
Well, I think I was up to like 1 o'clock last night coding and writing documentation
For Identity Server?
for Identity Server. So yeah, I mean it's I don't know. I mean consulting is an interesting sort of profession, especially when you're sort of self-employed like I am, is that it's feast or famine. And so when you get a ton of customer requests, well, that's what you have to go work on. And then, you know, hey, if it's around the holidays, nobody, you know, nobody's calling you. So I have free time to actually work on Identity Server or whatever other libraries. We actually work on many different libraries around this whole ecosystem. So we have other libraries that help with your, you know, if you're building a native .NET app that needs to do single sign-on. So this is the not just the server side, it's the client app side. I wrote a JavaScript library that helps with the single sign-on. So, I mean, you know, it's not just the server piece. It's from all the other moving parts that would be in this in your architecture. But yeah, you're right. It's I think I've said this before publicly, so I'll go ahead and say it again. I don't think I have a very balanced life. I'll say that I do spend a lot of time working. So, but you know, there you know, there are, you know, times when it's busy and there are times when it's slow. So, that's the, I think the lifestyle of the consultant.
I think you mentioned to me, before we started the podcast that you have a release candidate coming out. Is it today or this week?
Absolutely. This week we're going to be, so we have, let me just take a step back here. We have,
sorry, I should say this is September the 6th. So by the time this gets released, by the time the podcast is released, the release candidate will definitely be out.
Absolutely. So we have Identity Server 3. The number in Identity Server 3 is a generational number. So it's not necessarily a build or a release number, you know, a build number. So I think as of today, Identity Server 3 is, we released it, I don't know, a year and a half, almost 2 years ago. And it's at build 2.5.3 or something like that. And that is our Katana-based implementation. So if you're building applications on top of ASP.NET 4.6 and Katana, that would be the identity server you want to use. Of course, ASP.NET Core is the next wave of you know, ASP.NET technology from Microsoft. And so we're now have been working on Identity Server 4. So that's another generation number there. This is, like I said, ASP.NET Core based. This last month, we've been working very hard on it. So the month of August, Dominic and I both basically took off most of our other work and blocked time so that we could work on Identity Server 4. And we'll have a release candidate this week.
Congratulations on that.
Thanks.
And any final notes before we wrap up for today, Brock?
Yeah, no, I mean, again, it's... you know, a labor of love. I really like working on Identity Server. If you're interested in using it, there are a few things. We of course have, you know, it's up on GitHub. We're working on documentation and quick starts and things like that. Again, Identity Server 4 being release candidate, we're, you know, looking for feedback. If you're interested in learning more about it, I'm actually speaking at, Dev Intersection later this year in Las Vegas. I think it's in October, and I'm actually doing a 2-day workshop on kind of the modern, you know, authentication and authorization architecture on top of ASP.NET Core, and of course that'll include using Identity Server. And so I think this fall in November, Dominic and I are doing a 3-day workshop on Identity Server, or the same topic, the modern authentication and authorization, and Identity Server will be part of that.
Well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Brock Allen.
Yeah, no problem, Brian.
Thank you.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Hungaria by Lache Swing from the album Demo 2008.